recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening. Good evening, and thank you for being here. For those of you who were expecting to see Michelle Bernard this evening, unfortunately, she became too ill to travel from the East Coast. However, we have been blessed with one of her regular television co-panelists, an even better known and more widely published speaker. So we trust that none of you will be disappointed. This lecture is part of a week-long series of events organized to mark the inauguration of Beck Taylor as Whitworth's 18th president. Beck asked that the inauguration be a time to celebrate Whitworth's distinctive mission rather than his installation as president. Whitworth's mission to pursue both rigorous, open, intellectual inquiry and the integration of Christian faith and learning inspired the inauguration theme, celebrating a community of courage. Tonight we explore that theme as it relates to national politics and have asked our speaker to provide an inside look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. as we close on our very important midterm elections. We've also asked her to explore whether in this era of hyperpartisanship, she believes we have the courage to restore a sense of national community, a shared commitment to the common good that de Tocqueville once said was the genius of the American political system. Eleanor Clift became a contributing editor at Newsweek in September 1994. She writes on the Washington power structure, the influence of women in politics, and other issues. She is currently assigned to follow the jockeying over policy and politics in the new age of Obama. The change that Barack Obama promises has the potential of transforming how Washington does business, resetting priorities, and confronting the major challenges facing America. Eleanor brings her perspective to analyze whether our political leaders are capable of seizing the moment and what the impact will be of the new politically engaged population that we saw with this last election. Her column, Capital Letter, is posted each Friday on Newsweek.com. Formerly Newsweek's White House correspondent, Eleanor has also served as congressional and political correspondent for 6 years. She was a key member of the magazine's 1992 election team following the campaign of Bill Clinton from its start to Inauguration Day. In June 1992, she was named Deputy Washington Bureau Chief. As a reporter in Newsweek's Atlanta Bureau, Clift covered Jimmy Carter's bid for the presidency. She followed Carter to Washington to become Newsweek's White House correspondent, a position she held until 1985. Clift began her career as a secretary to Newsweek's national affairs editor in New York, becoming one of the first women at the magazine to move from secretary to reporter. She left Newsweek briefly in 1985 to serve as White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She returned to Newsweek the following year to cover the Iran-Contra scandal, which tarnished the Reagan White House. Eleanor is a regular panelist, and by far my wife's favorite, on the syndicated talk show, The McLaughlin Group. She has appeared as herself in several movies, including Dave, Independence Day, Murder at 1600, Rising Sun, and in the CBS series Murphy Brown. She and her late husband, Tom Brazaitis, who was a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, wrote 2 books together, War Without Bloodshed, The Art of Politics, and Madam President, Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling, which is available in paperback. Clift's book, Founding Sisters, is about the passage of the 19th Amendment, giving women the vote. Her most recent book, 2 Weeks of Life, A Memoir of Love, Death, and Politics, is about the loss of her husband, together with an examination of how we deal with death in America. Eleanor was a member of the Newsweek reporting team that contributed to A Long Time Coming, written by Evan Thomas last year. She lives in Washington, D.C., where she is on the board of the International Women's Media Foundation, the Center for Politics and Journalism, and the National Hospice Foundation. It is my pleasure and my honor to introduce Eleanor Clift. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here. Of course, I'm pleased to be anywhere where I get to finish a sentence without getting interrupted. I think some of you are probably familiar with the McLaughlin Group, which is a televised public affairs show, but it's really more like a televised food fight. It's the only show where you're expected to speak before you think, and interrupting each other, being generally rude, calling each other names is all considered part of good television today. And that's a subject for a whole other talk. But the show is the creation of John McLaughlin, formerly Father John McLaughlin. He is a former Jesuit priest. And for many years before he went on television, he taught in a boys' prep school in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I've met many of his former students, and they describe him coming into the classroom in his long robe with a velvet rope around the middle, a black Homburg hat, and white gloves. And every classroom had a beadle, B-E-A-D-L-E. It's an Anglican church term for the person who follows behind the bishop with the incense. And on the McLaughlin Group, Pat Buchanan is the beadle. He's the teacher's pet. And John would come into the classroom, remove the black Homburg hat, and then with great flourish take the gloves off, finger at a time, dropping them into the hat. And he once told me that the best and the most memorable teachers are those who project themselves as characters. And that's what he did in the classroom, and that's what he does on television. He got his start in politics. He ran for the U.S. Senate in Rhode Island in 1970 as a long-haired anti-war priest on the Republican ticket. He got 36% of the vote, so the Republic was safe, but he came to Washington and got a job in the Nixon White House as a speechwriter. During that period, he lived in the Watergate Hotel, which is a very fancy hotel, although it's recently been bankrupt like everything else. But at that time, it was at the height of its grandeur. And so John would be asked, how does someone who's taken a vow of poverty reconcile living in such grand surroundings? And John would point out that the Vatican then was actually part owner of the Watergate, so it was really company housing. And he actually, I think he actually lived there with his dog, Oliver. And if for those of you who are real fans of the group, you'll notice at the end there's a barking. That's his late dog, Oliver. He's been gone for a long time. Anyway, the show that he created is really designed like a men's locker room. It was originally five guys sitting around, interrupting each other, one-upping each other, being generally rude. My late husband used to call it towel snapping. It's not a style of conversation that women are comfortable with. And the first time I did the show, I felt like I was in a totally parallel universe. There was Pat Buchanan, Bob Novak. He died last year, but he was known as the Prince of Darkness. He had this permanent scowl on his face. And they would occasionally let me speak, and then they would simply go back to what they were doing. So it wasn't until Bob Novak, God bless him, would wag his finger in my face and say, Eleanor Clifton, people of her ilk, that I knew that I was finally accepted. I have learned how to interrupt, because if you didn't, the show would go by without you. But I do have trouble holding the floor. As soon as I start to speak, I can see the other panelists begin to levitate. And someone once paid me what I took to be a compliment, said that the McLaughlin Group without Eleanor is like a fox hunt without the fox. So a show never goes by that I don't say, let me finish. I think that will be on my tombstone. And a friend recently emailed me, and she said, you know, Chris Matthews has a segment on his show every night now called Let Me Finish. You should sue. Well, I don't think so, but I have learned as a woman on television that you have to keep a smile on your face, because if you have even a neutral expression, people will email you and you say, why are you so angry or shrill? All those nice men. And I have to say, the smile is not always heartfelt, but I think it is part of my staying power on the show that I'm a good sport, I don't take it personally, and I keep coming back for more. I think of myself like one of those blow-up dolls. You knock me down and I pop right back up. But that is a learned art, because I think here's where you get into some gender differences, which we were talking about on campus earlier today, that I would watch the men go at each other, hammer and tong, and then 5 minutes later they'd be talking about the Redskins. And I think women, we generally tend to take things more personally, and so I've had to learn to grow a tougher skin, especially when it comes to politics, which can be quite vicious these days in Washington. McLaughlin has never missed a show in its now 25 years. Even when he broke a hip when he was out power walking and tripped on an acorn, it was like on a Tuesday, and he convinced the hospital to discharge him on Thursday, and on Friday they brought him in a wheelchair and lifted him out of the wheelchair and into the chair. It was during the 04 campaign, because I remember he called John Kerry John Kelly. But he performed despite, I'm sure he was on a lot of pain medication, he really did well. So he really is an amazing figure. And he, as I said, is a former Jesuit priest, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Jesuits, but the Catholics consider them the Green Berets in the Army of God. They're highly educated, and John has a PhD. They're opinionated and articulate and very blustery. And so when John created this show, his goal was, as he put it, to create the greatest polarity. He wanted a fight. And so he brings panelists in who are guaranteed to be polar opposites. The show is oriented to the right. John worked for the National Review for many years, and I said he worked in the Nixon White House as a speechwriter. And so the four panelists, it's often, I feel, three against one. And I complained about that one day on the show with a smile on my face. And John said, no, he said, you're wrong. It's four against one. and as we go into this difficult political season for my side of the political aisle, I'm remembering 1994, which was the Republican takeover, when the Republicans captured the House for the first time in 40 years and took back the Senate. Bill Clinton was in power. And the show that we did immediately after that election, John's trademark is these questions that he kind of bellows out. And I can still hear it ringing in my ear. Is liberalism toast? I don't remember what I said at the time. I probably finessed it somehow. But a couple of weeks ago, the question was, will there be a Democratic wipeout, yes or no? Well, I can tell you that Democrats are bracing for the worst. Unlike 1994, when the Clinton White House and Democrats in general had very little inkling of what was coming at them. And I did a column recently interviewing a gentleman named William Galston. He's now a researcher with the Brookings Institution, but he was one of President Clinton's domestic policy aides. And he said the morning after the 94 election, the aides gathered in the Roosevelt Room, which is right down the hall from the Oval Office, and an aide was reading off the names of the Democrats who had lost that year, including Tom Foley, who represented this district and was actually the Speaker of the House. Bill Galston said, hearing the names, he said it was like the tolling of the bells. It was a really depressing event. And so Democrats are prepared this time, so if they do lose the House, it's not going to come as a huge surprise. And I think right now there are two camps in Washington. One camp would be those who see glimmers of hope that maybe the Democrats can hang on in the House and that they won't get wiped out. And the other is the woe is me camp. All is lost. I guess I put myself in the former camp, although I change each week depending on what poll I look at. But I think it's pretty obvious that the die is cast, that Republicans will make significant gains. But I don't think it's certain that they will sweep both chambers the way they did in 1994, or even that they'll net the 39 seats to regain the House majority. And I'll tell you why. The only thing that voters don't like more than Democrats are Republicans. The Republican brand has not recovered from the last time they controlled the Congress and the White House. The problem for the Democrats, however, is that this election is not really about the Republicans. It's about the Democrats. And it's if it's a referendum on whether Barack Obama has worked a miracle and revived the economy, the Democrats will lose. So the Democratic strategy is to put a face on the opposition. And some of the Republican Tea Party candidates are real doozies. I guess I don't really have to tell you about that because the cable news networks have been featuring them nightly. So if in individual races, if the Democrats can draw a contrast between the Democrat and make the alternative unacceptable, there's a possibility that the voters will stick with the devil they know as opposed to the devil they don't know. And I do remember when Barack Obama was first elected, The Onion, the satirical newspaper, ran one of the most memorable headlines, and it was, "Black man given worst job in America." Yet when Obama tries to remind people what he was dealing with, an economy that was on the verge of a shutdown, he is basically met with a wall of opposition saying, "Oh, you're just trying to blame it on Bush." And I think the president does have to look forward. I think probably President Bush has outlived his usefulness as a villain, and he has wisely postponed his memoir, which will be coming out next month after the election, and that will be interesting to see what revelations that he discloses, because I'm sure he got a significant advance that he's got to produce something juicy. So the Republican candidates that are out there, what they're doing is trying to remove attention from themselves. Many of them don't talk to the media. Some of them even avoid talking to voters. They don't want it to be about them. They want it to be, as I said, a referendum on the Democrats. And there's a torrent of money coming into this, into these races. Some accounts have the Republicans outspending the Democrats 8-1. And this is a result of the Supreme Court decision, the Citizens United decision, that allows corporate money to flow into campaigns without the donors being disclosed. So much of this money is anonymous. Frank Rich, the New York Times columnist, a week ago actually said that this is a billionaire's coup masquerading as a populist uprising. And I think the Democrats are trying in these closing weeks to try to put the focus on where all this money is coming from. And the extent to which the voters find what Obama represents threatening, to draw a contrast to say these are corporate interests coming in, and to get people to understand that these corporate interests may not necessarily line up with their interests. It's not an issue that so far is resonating, but it is an issue that we're going to have to deal with as a country and as a democracy, the extent to which corporate money is basically buying our democracy. There have been books written that we have the best Congress money can buy, and I think that's going to be proved many times over in this election cycle. But having said that, the energy out there on the Tea Party side of the agenda is real. The disgust with government is real. And the money that is coming in these closing weeks is amplifying that anger and that disgust on behalf of the Republicans. My favorite slogan is for Republicans is that government can't solve all our problems, elect us and we'll prove it. And there is a disconnect between what government's role in this election and the way it is being portrayed. If you remember how this all started, it was during the transition between President Bush and President Obama when the TARP was passed, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It is totally toxic out there with the voters. It bailed out the banks. But you know, the banks have paid that money back with interest, and it's going to end up costing a mere $50 billion, which is a small price to pay to keep the economy from sliding into a major depression. I actually think the coming together on TARP was a good moment, a courageous moment, if you will, in Washington, because the two parties came together. Everybody put their ideology aside. They came together and did what they thought was necessary to rescue the economy. I think Glenn Beck's grandchildren are going to like the health care bill, but it may take until then. I think it's an historic achievement that will stand. Yet, the amount of money that it cost and the amount of time that it took and all the deal-making really soured the American people on the way our government operates and portrayed President Obama as a big-spending liberal. I think this president's legislative record will match up with Lyndon Johnson, but that right now is not seen as a good thing by many Americans. The much-maligned stimulus bill, which is another thing that everybody hates, but practically everywhere I've gone in this country, somebody can point to me something that's been paid for that's positive by the stimulus bill. Saved a lot of jobs of teachers and firemen and cops, and I think that's a good thing, and it bailed out a lot of states that were teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. Time magazine went through the stimulus package. I mean, most people don't know it was a third tax cuts. Who knew? It contained the most ambitious energy legislation in history, $90 billion for clean energy, smart grid, and electric cars. And we need all that to be the competitive society of tomorrow and even today. $8 billion for a high-speed transportation initiative, $4.35 billion for the Race to the Top grants, which is, I think, a long overdue effort to get our public schools working better. In ordinary times, any one of these projects would have been major news. But the stimulus did not keep unemployment at 8%, and President Obama himself said that that's what it would do. It did save or create 2.5 jobs, and economists who look at it from a non-ideological perspective say that unemployment would be much worse if he didn't have it. I recently spent a week in China, and I was absolutely found it stunning. They may call themselves communists, but their capitalism is on steroids. And when I came back, I rarely tweet, but I did tweet, and I said just back from a week in Beijing and Shanghai, they should send some of those clowns on Capitol Hill to Beijing and Shanghai so they can see what real capitalism looks like. I mean, President Obama keeps touting this battery factory in Ohio, and it's a good thing, but they probably have 300 battery factories. They have completely stolen the march on solar equipment. They are now exporting half as much in solar equipment as we are in airplanes, and airplanes are our biggest export. I mean, these are the kinds of analogies that are really scary. And there are no global warming deniers in China. They know if they don't get sustainable energy right, they will drown in their own pollution and they'll take the rest of the planet with them. So it really makes you envious of the kind of the command economy where they can get things done while, you know, we are debating all these issues endlessly. So this president wants to extend transformative programs like the ones in the stimulus bill. And the question is, you know, will they survive in a Republican Congress? The midterms, this is kind of self-evident, is all about who shows up to vote. And the president is out there trying to rally his base, which includes young people. I have three grown sons, and my middle son, who lives in the Boston area, said he was, if his ultimate Frisbee team doesn't go to the Nationals, he will be coming for the John Stewart March on the weekend before the election, the March to Restore Sanity. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of a turnout he gets, and it will be compared to how many people turned out for Lynn Beck, because that's what we do in the media. But when John Stewart was first talking about this, he was suggesting signs that people might want to make. And my favorite sign is, I disagree with you about a lot of things, but I'm pretty sure you're not Hitler. So I think that would be a good starting point, because it's quite possible we will get a divided government. And what then? Will this president be able to adjust like Bill Clinton was able to do? Clinton went on to achieve a balanced budget with a Republican Congress and to sign an historic welfare reform bill. And when he delivered his first State of the Union address, the January or February after losing both houses of Congress, he paraphrased Walt Whitman and he said, I not only heard America singing, I heard America screaming. and in his, I think it was the following State of the Union, he did declare the era of big government is over, because he had definitely moved more towards the Republican agenda. When Clinton signed that welfare reform bill, it cost him with his base. His Peter Edelman, married to Marion Wright Edelman, Peter resigned. He was at the Health and Human Resources. And his wife, Marion Wright Edelman, was the founder of the Children's Defense Fund and had been Hillary Clinton's mentor. They were very upset because in that welfare reform bill, Clinton ended sort of the federal mandate to support children in the states, leaving it up to the states. And they saw that as an abdication of federal authority. So Clinton took some, he lost some professional friendships and some personal friendships in order to find an accommodation with the Republicans. And Newt Gingrich, for a time, was considered like a co-president. And Clinton, in one famous press conference, was asked if he was still relevant and actually had to remind people that he had some constitutional powers left. And then what the Republicans did was overreach. And there were two government shutdowns. And the American people, in the end, sided with President Clinton. And that was the beginning of Clinton's rebound in the public opinion polls. He went on to win re-election quite easily over Bob Dole. And so even if this November's election is a disaster for the Democrats, don't count out Barack Obama as somebody who can win re-election. Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan had pretty disastrous midterms. Reagan lost 26 seats in the House his first 2 years. Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush fared much better in the midterms and didn't win re-election. So there's really no correlation. And you could argue that if the Republicans do win the House, they will share some responsibility in governing. And if they don't perform, they make a nice foil for President Obama in running for re-election. So the politics can be played in a variety of different ways. But there are serious problems facing the country that it would be nice to see our politicians have the courage to confront. Among them, the Deficit Commission, or Fiscal Commission, is scheduled to report in December. This is a commission that initially was proposed as an act of Congress, and they were to come up with proposals to cut the deficit, and then the Congress would vote up or down on these proposals. The Republicans actually killed the Congressional Commission, and so the president appointed one, which does not have the statutory power that the congressional one would have, but there are serious players sitting on the commission, and it is expected to offer serious proposals in December, and President Obama is expected to then propose some serious programs or efforts to the Congress. So the question is, will the Republicans, if they are in charge of one or both houses, will they respond? Everybody likes to talk about cutting the deficit, and it's really a powerful, it's at the top of everybody's agenda. But when it comes to actually doing it, aren't many people who come up with programs that can win any political support? And most people sort of back away from the real tough issues. And I always remember President Reagan, he used to joke about the deficit. He said, the deficit is big enough to take care of itself. So I think the media has not, we have not done a good job explaining the difference between the short-term deficit spending that this president is doing to try to dig the economy up out of a hole, and the longer-term structural deficits, which definitely have to be dealt with, but now's not the time. You don't want to put the brakes on an economy that is as frail as this one. So I think you will, come January, you will have a clash probably between the Tea Party conservatives and the traditional Republicans. On the McLaughlin group last week, John asked, will it be a friendly, will it be on a scale of 1 to 10, will it be a civil war or a smooth transition? And Pat Buchanan said it will be a friendly civil war. I don't know exactly what that means. I said it will be a shotgun marriage. And that could be a distinction without a difference, which is probably about as close to agreement as you can get in Washington. But I want to talk about, so I think we'll see what our politicians are made of once we get a new landscape on Capitol Hill. If you look at the likely leaders, if the Republicans took over the Senate, there would probably be a leadership challenge of Mitch McConnell, the current leader, because he has been rather distant from the Tea Party people. And you would see Senator Vitter, or Senator DeMint, I guess Senator DeMint is the hero on the right, and so you could have a leadership fight in the Senate. In the House, there may be a leadership fight as well, but likely speaker would be John Boehner, who has been a kind of innocuous figure on Capitol Hill for quite a long time. He's been in office since 1990. He was at the first Gingrich revolution. He's known mainly for the color of his skin, which is kind of an orange tan. And he plays a lot of golf. He's not known to be an ideas man. And so it's hard for me to imagine Speaker Boehner and President Obama getting together and hashing out serious policy issues the way President Clinton did with Newt Gingrich. Whatever you think of Newt Gingrich, and you're going to hear a lot more from him because he's essentially running for president, and which makes me want to add that there are lots of reasons to run for president short of actually thinking you might win. But Newt probably thinks he can win. He is an ideas factory, and when I covered him on Capitol Hill, he had a staff person who told me that they had a big box in Newt's office that was called Newt's Ideas, and then they had a much smaller box that said Newt's Good Ideas. But Gingrich and Clinton really did hash things out, and of course they ultimately clashed, and over the shutdown, Clinton won, and there was the memorable moment when Gingrich flew with Clinton, I think it was to some funeral or something overseas, and he thought they were going to talk about the budget on the way back, and instead Clinton played hearts with his aides on the whole time and didn't negotiate with Gingrich. And Gingrich also had to get out the back of the plane. And he complained about this over breakfast to reporters. Disaster. The headline in the New York Post had him wearing diapers and weeping. It said, "Crybaby Newt." It's these little moments that can capture so much. And in today's social media, internet world, any gaffe a politician makes travels so fast that there's, I don't want to say there's often no recovering, because it can be overtaken by another story 10 minutes later. And so it's politics today moves with dizzying speed. So I want to also talk about, I identify very much with women in the political arena, and women are underrepresented and fighting to be heard. And I remember being in the hall in 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro was named to the ticket, the Democratic ticket, and there were a lot of women in that hall, you know, dabbing at their eyes. It seemed so, like such a momentous accomplishment. And then the campaign descended into a debate about her husband's tax returns. And she said he didn't want to release them. He ultimately did, weeks later. But she said he didn't want to release them. "You know how Italian men are," she said. And that was the end. All the coverage said, if she can't stand up to her husband, how is she going to stand up to the Soviets? The Democrats lost 49 states that year, and there was some effort to try to blame it on Jerry Ferraro, but her line was that it was Morning in America, that was Reagan's campaign, his advertising campaign, and the Democratic ticket couldn't have won even if God herself were on it. So that was my first sort of aha moment in national politics for women. And then in 1992, there was what we called the year of the woman, when more women were elected than had ever been elected before. But these were Democratic women. And what we're seeing this year is very different. And I remember in 92, some male congressman was quoted saying, "There are so many women on Capitol Hill that the place looks like a shopping mall." And Pat Schroeder, who represented a district in Colorado and was then the dean of the women in Washington, and she had a really quick wit, and her response was, "I wonder where he shops," because it was still so overwhelmingly male that there were only a handful of women, but it was the year of the woman. And this year we see an influx of women candidates, and they are Republican, and they are being credited to Sarah Palin as an inspirational figure, and the phrase is used in Washington that this is the Palin effect. Newsweek, last week we did a cover on the so-called Mama Grizzlies. That's the phrase that Sarah Palin used, and that she anoints the women that she's endorsed. And I heard her speak in Bakersfield, actually last weekend, and she said, "The Mama Grizzlies are growling, so get ready." And they kept the phrase, like soccer moms or security moms or Joe Sixpack, captures something about the national mood. And there's a group like this, often more than one group, in every election. The Mama Grizzlies are very different, certainly, from the women who were elected in 92. They do not advocate for traditional, what we think of traditional women's issues, and in fact, they want the government out of education and out of health care. And so, in putting together this Newsweek cover, I was asked to contact some moderate Republican women and get a sense of how they feel about this new generation of women coming into the party. I reached two of them. There aren't that many around, actually. Connie Morella was a member of Congress representing a Maryland district for a lot of years. She was a Republican every Democrat loved. She's a wonderful human being. And the other was Christy Todd Whitman, who had been elected governor of New Jersey and reelected and was then President Bush's EPA director before she resigned. Governor Whitman has a book out called It's My Party Too and a website, and she keeps trying to revive the moderate wing of the Republican Party. Anyway, Connie Morella, her quote was that the mama grizzlies has a catch to it, and you save your cubs, but what they're lacking is solutions. They want to take their country back. Back to where? And Governor Whitman basically said, if what you're doing, oh, she didn't mention Christine O'Donnell's name. She's the woman who won in Delaware. But that's clearly who she was talking about. She said, if what you're doing is sending someone to Washington to cut the deficit, why on earth send someone who can't manage her own finances? How does that give the voters a level of confidence? Now, Christine O'Donnell has said that the fact that she has struggled makes her sympathetic, makes her just like you. And I'm sure many of you saw her ad, which begins, I'm not a witch, I'm you. That's going to go down as one of the memorable ads. She has not held a real job since 2004. She's lived off campaign donations while not paying her staffers. But you know, she's taken a real hammering this election season, and I suspect some of that is going to make her a sympathetic figure, but probably for people who already support her. She's 16 points behind her Democratic rival. It's highly unlikely she will win. But when I listened to her victory speech on a couple of weeks ago, she made the point that the Tea Party is not about winning. They want to change a system that they see as unresponsive. Now, I would be with her on that, but I suspect her definition of responsive and mine would be very different. And so in these closing weeks, I mean, I think if you're a voter, it's really difficult to sort out where the truth is. I mean, because they're just slamming the mud at each other. I live in the District of Columbia, so we don't have anything at stake. Our very fine mayor lost, but he's being succeeded by someone who I think is going to be fine, too. So we don't have much of a voice in any of these races. But many of the more controversial candidates are using what they call the duct tape strategy, which is where they basically don't deal with the traditional media. And they take their cues from Sarah Palin, who communicates through her Twitter account, and she has had some memorable ones. You know, don't retreat, reload. Don't deal with the mainstream media, MSM. You know, just talk to hometown voters. So there is no comparable king or queen maker like Sarah Palin on the Democratic side. Nancy Pelosi is so vilified, and the ad that her rival or is playing against her has her as the witch in the Wizard of Oz. She's going to win her San Francisco district, but she's not popular. And Hillary Clinton is off the playing field because she's Secretary of State, and Secretaries of State don't get partisan. Now, I want to close here a little bit about Hillary because she really is getting rave reviews for the face that she presents for America to the world. And the funny thing is that conservative men now love her, and Tony Blankley, who used to be on the McLaughlin group, said, changed for him when he watched her down those shots in West Virginia like she'd done it before. And this rumor floats around Washington, and Bob Woodward, the super journalist, gave it some credence a week or so ago that Hillary would join the ticket to strengthen the ticket and Joe Biden would go to the Secretary of State. I think there's credibility to that because it makes a certain amount of sense. I think it probably won't happen. But I would keep my eye when Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, resigns sometime next year. Hillary Clinton could well succeed him. And if she does, if Obama does win re-election, I think that would set her up in 2016 as a pretty powerful candidate. But there have been books written and PhD theses on why Hillary failed to get the nomination when, as she put it, I coulda, shoulda, woulda, and the sexist coverage of the campaigns of both Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin. But I must say, there was one line that I, it's probably kind of sexist, but I liked it. Chris Matthews said that comparing Sarah Palin to Hillary Clinton is like comparing an igloo to the Empire State Building. So on election day, we will know whether Sarah Palin's endorsements drive voters outside, beyond Republican primaries. But I think she's already having an influence on the shape of the field for 2012, whether she runs herself or not. And I must say, it's pretty amazing for a failed vice presidential candidate who quit her job as governor, and she's been able to turn every deficit to her advantage. So I know the theme of this conference is courage, but I think there's a difference between courage and chutzpah, and I'd put her in the second category. But she is definitely someone to be reckoned with. And as a woman, I gotta admire it. I don't want her to be president, but I gotta admire what she's doing out there. And I would hope that the people who do carry the ultimate burden of leadership in our society after the votes are counted on election day, you know, will have the courage to rise to the occasion and do the responsible thing for the country. And compromise has become a dirty word, but it's at the heart of how our system operates. And so I would hope that the two parties can come together and that there are some serious leaders on each side of the aisle, but I'm not going to bet my house on it. So with that, I'd like to leave a little time for questions. I think thank you for being such an attentive audience.
We do have a few minutes for questions. I think Greg, is Greg here? Okay. I think Greg has volunteered to run the mic, so I'll point to people and he'll find you as you have questions.
Okay.
If you would use the mic, we're recording tonight's activities and so we need the microphone to pick those up. So if you'd wait for Greg, he'll be with you.
Now, I must have said something that provoked something over here. Okay.
Why do you think we're really in Afghanistan? I hear things about, an oil, gas pipeline, lithium and other minerals, geopolitical positioning near Pakistan and so forth. Why do you think we're really there?
I think we're there because we're worried about Pakistan and its nuclear arsenal falling into the hands of the extremists. And we can't go into Pakistan, so we're doing the next best thing or next worst thing. And I would recommend reading Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, because he does describe that laborious decision-making process that the president went through, in which he kept asking for strategies that would require no more troops or fewer troops, and he did not get them. I think that's one of the reasons the National Security Advisor is out of his job, and there's a new one being installed. I think this president was looking for a way out, is still looking for a way out. But when you've never served, you're inexperienced, you're worried about the political fallout, like so many presidents before him, I think he's gotten sort of trapped. But there is one quote in the Woodward book where he says, if this strategy doesn't work, I'm not going to be like all those other presidents and keep doubling down. So let's hope he follows through on that if that becomes the situation.
Sir, we have a question up in here.
Yes, you were talking about fiscal policy and fiscal responsibility earlier, and how on both sides people want to see the economy turn around and our deficit certainly lower. What is your take on the Bush tax cuts? And, you know, they've kind of been put off. Do you think they'll reach a solution later on in this year?
They've got to reach a solution before the end of the year. And the assumption is they'll do it in the lame duck session after the election. They will definitely extend them for the middle class. And if I had to guess, it'll probably go for the whole schmear because they're going to have listened to the voters. And the voters who scream loud about the deficit are also screaming loud about keeping those tax cuts in place. You know, they were written to expire because there was no more money after a certain point, and it's hugely expensive. One compromise I think they could come up with, instead of, it's now over $250,000 the president wants to phase them out. You hear a lot of people squawking about how you really can't live on $250,000. And affects a lot of small businesses. Well, a lot of those small businesses are turns out to be, you know, very prosperous law firms and that kind of thing. But set that aside. If you raise the $250,000 to $500,000, so you could at least nip the millionaires and billionaires, I think maybe there's a compromise there. So, but they definitely have to do something, or else people will be screaming come next year.
Yeah, I have a question about the media in general. As a poli-sci major and someone who listens to all different channels, I'd like to know, is there anybody in the media who is trying to bring rationality to the discourse, the political discourse, or is the future of media just listening to people repeating the same talking points, not getting anything really out in detail, listening to people shout over one another so that we're almost driven away from trying to understand what's going on in our country?
PBS, the NewsHour, Jim Lehrer, C-SPAN. I watch both of those. I also like Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. She breaks down issues. I mean, she's got her political bias, but she really does try to get beyond the talking points. Oh, I hate the talking points because they just inflame issues and you don't really learn anything. I agree, but you know, the people who put these programs together look at what gets ratings. And if we've met the enemy are us. those are the shows that get the viewers. You know, it's like, I guess it's like watching a, you know, NASCAR or something. You want to see the, you want to see the cars collide. So it's not my cup of tea, but I mean, my habits are, I turn on C-SPAN in the morning. If it's really too boring, I will switch to Morning Joe. I like the conversation that they have on. I'm not that wild about the, you know, she's Marilyn Monroe and he's James Dean and, you know, they have this on-air marriage. I mean, all those dynamics are kind of weird, I think. But they have good people on and they have good conversations. I like that show. Then when I go for a run, I listen to NPR. And I think NPR does a wonderful job. And then in the evenings, if I'm home in time, I watch the NewsHour, and then I will get a little bit of a fix on MSNBC. I tried to watch the new Parker Spitzer show. In fact, I reviewed it for Politics Daily blog. It's kind of tough to... I mean, they promised more elevated conversation, and it's two interesting people. I mean, Spitzer, despite his difficulties, to put a benign word on it, is a very smart guy, and he was the sheriff of Wall Street, and he knows all about what they did on Wall Street during the economic collapse. And the first night show, he interviewed somebody who he had prosecuted, and that person had paid $4 million. He was a trader, paid $4 million in fines, and was banned from the profession for life. course, he's now resurfaced with a website that's very popular. But what struck me is that the two men had never met face to face. It was all done through lawyers. So that I thought was, you know, quite interesting. And Kathleen Parker is she calls herself a conservative columnist, but she's like David Brooks with the New York Times. I mean, she's at variance with conservative dogma a lot of the time. And I remember during the 08 campaign, she had written something critical about Sarah Palin, you know, saying that she wasn't qualified to be president. And I was sitting next to her at some event, and she had 1,000 emails, hate mails from conservatives, you know, saying that she deserted the cause. And I remember her saying, I didn't know this device could take that many emails. She's an interesting thinker, and she's she's got an edge to what she writes. And so I would think they would have the potential to put together a good show, but it hadn't clicked yet.
Hello. I know that the economy will be a big issue in the next midterm election. How do you think each party will sort of use the economy in terms of maybe political capital?
Well, the Republicans are saying you spent all this money on the stimulus and it didn't keep unemployment at 8%. You know, your economic policies don't work. You know, throw out the Democrats, elect us. And the Democrats are saying the Republicans want to go back to Bush-era policies. They want his tax cuts. They want the same spending levels as an 08. You know, it's old wine and not so new bottles. And so I think that's the fight. But because the Democrats are the ones in power, it really becomes more about the Democrats. And if the Republicans win, it's not as if they did anything to earn it. I mean, they haven't put out any realistic, serious ideas. They are just the default position. And so it's hard to know how it will all shake out if they do, in fact, you know, get some power. It might be a good thing if they do have a vested interest in governing as opposed to just, you know, taking pot shots from the sidelines. That's happened in the past, and it could well happen again.
So with politics in general seeming to become like more and more stratified, where do you see the future of American politics heading? Are we only going to become more and more separated by our beliefs, or is there any sort of reconciliation that might be possible, at least from what you see?
I think if you look historically, that very rarely does one thing stay for a long time. I thought Obama was the healer. I mean, he ran. We're not red states and blue states. You know, we're America. But I was reminded that President Bush, George W. Bush, when he ran in 2000, ran as the uniter, not the divider. And he certainly left a very divisive trail behind him. So it's not necessarily so much the fault of each of these individual men. It's kind of the dynamic that's at play in our society. But, you know, after Carter was defeated, Newsweek and other publications ran stories about, you know, can any one man govern this country? I mean, it looked like we were ungovernable. And Reagan, although I certainly didn't agree with a lot of his policies, through the force of his personality, he restored sort of the faith in the economy and in government. So, I would like to think that Obama can still show us some of the great promise that he brought with him when he was elected in 2008.
You mentioned sexism in the 08 election and against Hillary Clinton especially. I remember one quote was, "Who wants to watch a woman age in front of the American people?" So what would you say has to change in the media for women to become treated more equally as a candidate?
Well, it's interesting. The sexism in the 08 campaign really didn't get that much attention because we had this phenomenon of a black man seriously contending for the presidency, and everybody was much more concerned about any evidence of racism. And I think women felt like the media really didn't take as seriously the fact that a woman was now in serious contention. They were so taken with this other phenomenon. I think women are taken seriously in the society, and a lot of this is kind of a holdover from, you know, earlier generations and people just trying to be funny when things really aren't funny. But you can't look around and see, you know, three women on the Supreme Court, three successive secretaries of state who are women, and look around your college. It's dominantly female. So I think when examples arise that seem sexist, it's nice to point them out, to have the courage to point them out, and to also have the courage not to fight every battle. Sometimes, you know, people say things, they don't really mean any harm, or it's generational, and I think, you know, some things you let go by, but when you see an important battle that should be fought, to have, you know, the courage to stand up and stand your ground.
Keeping in mind it's after 11 p.m. at her house,
oh.
Time for a couple more questions, perhaps. There was a gentleman here, and then perhaps one more after that.
You mentioned your trip to China and the economic development, stuff like that. What do we need to do as a country to compete with them? Can we compete with them? Especially with a divided government like you're talking about.
Right. You know, we as an economy, we have been the most dynamic in the world. And we're still ahead of the Chinese in many ways in research. And they're, what was interesting to me, I visited one of their schools, and everybody sat there, you know, so politely and so organized, and I think there were 40-some-odd kids in the class. And later, some of the officials were saying that they are too regimented and they don't turn out enough creative people. So we have great strength in this country, so I think we can rediscover that, but we can't keep fighting over, you know, global warming and energy policy when the rest of the world has accepted the phenomenon of global warming and creating a whole manufacturing base around it. So I think sometimes we get caught up in these, global warming becomes an ideological battle instead of how do we get an edge in some of these industries that are clearly the green industries, sustainable industries of tomorrow. So Obama has set a goal of doubling U.S. Exports. You can't do that without actually making something in this country, and we've decimated our manufacturing base in a lot of ways. And I think the green industry is a way to recapture some of that. So all of this requires leadership, and it requires accommodation also. Oh, I think that's important. I also think our schools, I know this is a four-year traditional college, but community colleges, this administration has significant initiatives to boost community colleges because I think the president has set a goal of 5 million more college graduates because a lot of people can't afford four-year colleges. The community colleges also do a good job of training people for jobs that actually exist. And Peter, well, I didn't mean that as a slam, but well, Peter Diamond, who's the MIT economist who just won the Nobel Prize in economics, is Obama's choice to sit on the Federal Reserve Board. The Republicans have been blocking his nomination for 6 months. Now maybe they're a little embarrassed, they'll let him go through. But he's an expert in sort of employment policy. You know, how you create a population that matches the jobs that you're creating. So I mean there are people who can look at this and can figure out where we, you know, put our resources and our money, and community colleges play a big role in that. I didn't mean that as a slam to the four-year liberal arts. I really didn't. because I think there'll always be jobs for people who can write and who can think. And as we talked earlier over dinner, you young people in this audience, you'll have to reinvent yourself several times over your lifetime, and to have the basic skills to be able to do that is important. But my point is that our education system has to also be adapted for this competitive world of tomorrow. You know, when you go to a lot of institutions and you see a lot of Asian people there, and they're here on temporary visas, and they're going back to China because China's now a happening place. I have these neighbors who have two little adopted Chinese girls, and I always thought, oh, how nice, they've adopted these little Chinese girls. Now I'm looking, ooh, they took these lovely girls away from this wonderful homeland. I mean, it's just you see the world through different eyes when you go to a country like that. And they have their problems. They have, you know, 700 million people in the countryside who are going to migrate to the cities looking for a better life, and they have to accommodate that. They have a lot of poverty. Their per capita income is still very low, but they have a class of Chinese, you know, millionaires, billionaires that they've definitely figured out the Western style of life. But they also see the mistakes that we've made. And they're not going to drive around in SUVs. That's not the way to go. So.
Last question, sir.
Yeah, you touched on Beck and Stewart and the polarization of the media and political elites. Do you think that shows in line with what the American public is going? Do you think that the American public is becoming equally polarized? Or do you think that's just being played out and the message we're receiving is more polarized? And if so, why? And do you think we can get back to more of a centrist area of cooperation?
You know, I think if you talk to most people that they're not so hidebound on one side or the other. I mean, I think television heightens those differences, but we definitely do have, you know, areas of the country, states, cities, areas that are, we would call them blue or they would call them red. I live in the District of Columbia, which is so blue. When the Democrat won the primary, they have a token Republican running for mayor, but everybody knows that he's not going to win. And Maryland, which neighbors us, is a very blue state, and Virginia is what went for Obama, went Democratic for the first time in a long time, but is trending quite red. And when people move to town, I swear, Republicans gravitate to McLean and Old Town, and Democrats go to Bethesda. So, and David Brooks has written about this, that we kind of gravitate to our own. So I do think we're polarized in that sense, but I don't think it's as extreme as the politicians make it out to be for their own purposes.
And on that somewhat positive note. conclude. Please join me in thanking Eleanor Cliff.
Thank you.
Good night, and thank you.